Today's program was brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
I'm Erin Fairbanks, host of The Farm Report. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Joshua David Stein, Variety Hour. Joshua David Stein, Variety Hour. Half hour!
Hello, this is Joshua David Stein from the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour Half Hour. A half hour devoted to all things loosely and tightly related to food. This week, after a one-week break, we will be discussing the jumbo issue of shrimp, and we have two wonderful filmmakers and a wonderful Delta blues musician for the second half. So the reason why we're talking about shrimp today is there are two new documentaries which recently became available to the widespread public about shrimping. One is called Raising Shrimp, and one is called Head On, Shrimping in the Low Country. And I reviewed both of them for Eater in a joint review. And here's just the first graph or two of that review. Don't believe Red Lobster. There's no such thing as endless shrimp. Just as there is a bottom to the bottomless cup of coffee and the ever-set table is a fairy tale, shrimp, too, has an end. And yet we eat shrimps as if they're eternal. Pacified by Cheddar Bay biscuits, we hoover the little forgettable fuckers like they were fried crustacean cocaine, and we're a bunch of Bret Easton Ellis's. For $15.99, it would be foolish not to. That's a cheap-ass meal in the first place, and for something that's endless, forget about it. If you wish to continue your shrimp eating untroubled, stop reading and certainly do not see two newly available documentaries about the shrimp industry. The first, Head On, Shrimping in the Low Country, is a short film made by George Motz, the mutton-chopped author of Hamburger America. Essentially, it's a 12-minute elegy for the withering shrimping industry on the South Carolina coast. The second, a much longer and less poetic film, is Raising Shrimp, a documentary produced by and starring a fire and brimstone environmental engineer named Ted Kaplow. It's about as straightforward and dry a film as the title suggests, 60 minutes on raising shrimp. But even if you don't think you care about raising shrimp, and I don't intrinsically, I recommend it, for it makes a first-rate horror flick anyway. Well, I'd like to welcome onto the program George Motz, the mutton-chopped author of Hamburger America. George, you there?
There, how you doing?
How's it going? And Sarah Curry, one of the producers of Raising Shrimp. Sarah, are you there?
I'm here, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
So as both of you know, shrimp is the most popular seafood in America. And as I say later on in the review, I think very few Americans know actually how their shrimp is made. Sarah, could you start us off talking a little bit about where most of the shrimp, I guess 90% of the shrimp that Americans eat comes from?
Yeah, most of
No, go on, Sarah.
Most of the shrimp we eat is imported from Southeast Asia and Central America, and a lot of that is not tested, maybe how we would like it to be tested, and maybe it's breaded or treated with or something else before it makes its way to the supermarket. So a lot of the times when we buy shrimp in the grocery store, it's not very clear where it came from and how it was raised.
And that's because if you have something that's a prepared food, you don't need to say the origin of it. Is that correct?
Right. That's the little loophole in the country of origin labeling law.
So you're which raising
also applies to restaurants, obviously.
Right. So Raising Shrimp, the documentary Raising Shrimp, is about sort of the environmental cost of farm-raised shrimp. Mostly internationally, and it's the environmental cost. And George, it seems like Head On is more about the human cost that influx of cheap shrimp causes in certain communities in South Carolina. Tell me about your film, Head On. You're mostly a hamburger guy.
I'm mostly a hamburger guy, but I do appreciate all those American food ways that exist out there that people don't pay attention to. And of course, one of them is definitively it has to do with shrimping and any kind of seafood in South Carolina coast for sure. I mean, Marcel is more of a love letter to, or almost like it's a film of hope. Hope that that people would see this and understand that, you know, it's not all is lost in the shrimping industry for sure. That, especially in South Carolina, is that, what they're doing is they're moving from a, they're just pulling every shrimp they can find out of there and shipping it all over the place for money, to a model where they're only selling high quality shrimp in small quantities to the locals and to local restaurants. Trying to educate their own people.
I think one of the things that I found most interesting about watching both films together is, you know, there is as well, though, George, but correct me if I'm wrong. Anyone can jump in and tell me I'm wrong. I'm totally open to that. But, you know, those South Carolina ocean, they're trawlers, right? I mean, that's how they bottom trawling is traditionally how shrimping is done. And that also comes at an environmental cost. So it seems just a difficult situation to negotiate. There is this culture which you want to preserve, but then there's also the environment that you want to protect.
This is true, but I mean, there's so many different environmental laws that protect everything else but the shrimp in the water these days. So, for example, there's all the turtle laws where they actually had to redesign a lot of the trawler net so that the sea turtles had a way to escape the net so they wouldn't get caught and killed. So there are certain rules like that that definitely protect, environmental laws that protect animals and the different seafood that's out there. They also have rules where they have to throw stuff back. If they catch a shark, gotta go back. A lot of the stuff that they do bottom drag.
You're talking about bycatch.
All the bottom trash goes back.
You're talking about bycatch there, right?
Bycatch. All the bycatch goes back. They're not actually not allowed to keep bycatch, especially all the stuff that I'm sure you saw a shot there where you see a shark, the hammerhead shark, and they're in the middle of a pile of shrimp. I caught that shot just as the net opened, and then I cut out before you see a guy reach over and throw it back in the water. He swims off again.
Sarah,
there are different rules like that.
Sarah, you want to jump in there?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think I absolutely agree that I think just from having experience speaking with fishermen in Louisiana and shrimpers particularly, you know, everyone wants to maintain the fishery and their jobs and this lifestyle into the future. And so everyone wants to be addressing these problems, but I think the trawling is still a huge problem. I do know of a shrimper out of Louisiana who pays particular attention to kind of where the fish are in the area. It's called the Anna Marie. This is both this guy Lance Nacio. And so he's kind of making headway with how he's fishing offshore. And I think if more people start to do that, and I'm sure they're going to, because I think the idea of selling these wild shrimp as kind of an artisanal seafood to locals is kind of like the movement that this is the way it's going anyway. So I think that's great. And as if we can keep moving forward with making sure the turtle excluder devices are out there and these fisheries are getting better, then all that's a positive thing.
That's interesting. It sounds like there's a twofold path that you envision, Sarah. And George, it's kind of like the synthesis of these two viewpoints, that you have this wild shrimp caught in the low country and in the Gulf, which stays local and stays artisanal. That's kind of the gourmet shrimp. And then Sarah, and George, you don't address this in your documentary, but Sarah, it is the focus of yours. And then for that, 4 pounds of shrimp that Americans eat, Sarah, in your mind, most of that is American farm-raised shrimp, correct?
I would love to see that, and I think that'd be huge for our shrimp-loving country, because I was just counting up before the show, so we highlight these closed recirculating shrimp farms in our film, and I've interviewed a handful of them on our blog, and gotten to know some of them, but I just counted up. There are like 31 out there right now, from Minnesota to a ton in Indiana, Illinois, Iowa, Wisconsin, Maryland, New York.
I'm going to jump in, Sarah. Can you just describe or explain what a recirculating shrimp farm is? The thrilling question of what a recirculating shrimp farm is for our listeners?
Well, yes, it's. I'm tempted to explain what a normal shrimp farm is first so people understand why this is a better thing. In general,
you may
shrimp
do that.
Are raised in ponds near the coast, and oftentimes mangroves are destroyed to create space for that. And then the effluent, so you put shrimp in this pond, you feed them, they poop, and all that wastewater and feed water kind of goes back out into the environment and can be harmful in various ways. And the idea of the recirculating shrimp farm is to close that cycle a bit. So taking the water in the shrimp tank, filtering it, and kind of putting it back in the system, and eventually having kind of this solid waste that's used as fertilizer other ways. But some other people are using biofilters to clean the water, but it's essentially not releasing all this what's generally wastewater back out into the environment, but treating it on site. And so then the water that you eventually do release can go right back into the municipal kind of water system. And it's cool because these can be done anywhere and they don't have to be on the coast, which is why we're finding them in the middle of the U.S., which is really cool. I'm friends with some of these small fish farmers on Facebook, and they're all like, get your shrimp for Thanksgiving. And I'm like, man, I wish I could, because it's super sustainable and it's actually really delicious.
And George, do you have a bead on how sort of the shrimpers that you profile in your film, how they're getting on in this kind of, you know, this brave new shrimp world?
Well, you know, it's a new world for them, because they've never had to deal directly with customers. They have people who come right down to their dock now and want to buy directly. And they realize right away that they're making more money because they can sell, you know, for a slightly less, lower price than they would find at the wholesaler. But they could also make more money. So it's a really smart business model. A lot of them are very confused by it too. A lot of them don't understand why this is happening. And some of the restaurants are walking down to the dock and asking for, you know, shrimp with a head on, which is something they, you know, it's a very complicated process where they have to come in with the shrimp with the head on. It's stored differently, and they don't understand why. So this is not the way we've done things. And these restaurants are saying, we're going to buy it directly from you because we want it with the head on. It tastes better.
Yeah, you profile a couple of restaurants. Yeah, you profile a couple of restaurants down there that the guy who has the Italian restaurant who uses these head-on shrimp, which infuse obviously the more flavor, come more juice, the head juice. Delicious head juice. And that seems like watching it on one level, it is a portrait of a dying industry when they're trying to go mass, because they do compete with all the farms that in your film, Sarah, you profile. But then it looks like the way forward for them again is just a super local movement. And that seems like the paradox of shrimp. It's either super local or totally rootless. You can do it anywhere,
right,
Indiana.
That's really their only selling point. That's all they have at this point. At this point, the industry will die locally if they don't try to convince people, or just at least try to, you know, be part of that sort of, I guess, gourmet art partisan movement. Otherwise, they will die. The whole thing will fall apart. I can tell you right now. they're very concerned about that. They're very aware of that. That's actually happening to them, and they know this is the only way out. It's actually a really good way out, because this is the way things used to be. It's the way it should be. And I always tell people that, you know, whenever you have a real shrimp, I've eaten shrimp cooked directly with seawater on a shrimp boat, on a trawler, and there is absolutely nothing in the world like it at all. It doesn't taste like shrimp, but the shrimp that everyone knows is shrimp.
Right, so now...
You convince people that shrimp tastes much better when it's wild-caught and it's eaten locally, then you will have a lot of converts, for sure.
Right, it's kind of like now it's what they've always been doing, but now you can call it artisanal. Whereas before, it's just normal.
Deal. That's about as close as it gets.
Yeah. And Sarah, what do you think?
Well, I wonder, too, if it's about just, you know, freezing it versus not freezing it, right? Because a lot of this you know, the shrimp, obviously, that we get from halfway across the world has been frozen for who knows how long. And sometimes, you know, in the Gulf, they are freezing the shrimp on the boat. And even at these bigger farms, they freeze it and then they thaw it and whatever. And the great thing about these recirculating farms, and I'm guessing if they're buying it straight off the docks in South Carolina, too, it's that freshness, that quality of not being frozen, which is really nice. And
right, but they still have a very, very short shelf life, regardless if they're farm-raised or if they're wild-caught. They have a very short shelf life, so they do need to be frozen. What they do in South Carolina, though, is they, and I'm sure they do in other fisheries as well, is that they deep-freeze them in salt water, which apparently the salinity will protect the fibers of the shrimp itself. And I mean, the fresh frozen shrimp is actually not bad at all. Not bad at all. But it's the problem that I think with the world right now is that you've got the shrimp is being deep frozen and stored for up to like 2 or 3 years in some cases, and that's just ridiculous.
Well, I think that, you know, what I always, and as I mentioned in the review, I think the root problem is the fact that we could think that anything is endless, like that there's no cost for just an endless spigot of shrimp being, you know, shot right into our gullets. I mean, there is an environmental cost. Although, Sarah, you're saying that of all the proteins, this one might actually be somewhat endless. I mean, shrimp eat shit. They survive on shit. So they can, you know, it's a cycle of life.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's a really great protein to try to raise in the U.S. As far as having it be endless, I mean, I think that's, we need to kind of get off that, you know, state of mind where anything is endless and remember that there are seasons and all this. But yeah, the idea of having these small recirculating farms in a lot of areas of the country so that it's putting the food source closer to where people are eating it, and that way, you know, they do harvest, you know, some of these farms have 3 or 4 harvests a year, which is, you know, more frequent than, you know, maybe once or twice a year for the season or something like that. But I don't know if the idea of endless shrimp is necessarily right. What we're saying.
No, but it is a rather sustainable protein. Well, speaking of ends,
yes, absolutely. Compared to, you know, a ton of the other farmed fish out there and even, you know, other types of protein where you're growing a lot of feed and you're using a lot of water and all these things, we think that this is definitely an option that holds a lot of promise for the future.
Okay. Well, before we go, Sarah, tell us where we can see Raising Shrimp.
Well, it will be available for streaming on Amazon in the next few weeks and available for purchase of DVD on Amazon and elsewhere in the next few weeks as well.
Okay.
So,
thank you, Sarah.
And also our first film, Fish Meat, actually is about fish farming in general and kind of dispels that notion of fish farming as black and white, good and bad, and explores more the diverse array of fish farms. And that's available on Amazon and iTunes as well.
Okay. Thank you very much. And George Motz, where can we see Head On?
Well, if you go to Eater, yes, you can Google it. It's Head On, Shrimping in the Lowcountry. It's on Vimeo. It's on, now it's linked on Eater. You can find it on Eater for sure.
Okay. Guys, thank you so much. It was a wonderful discussion about a small but important protein in our lives, shrimp. We'll be back right after a short break with Hugh Poole.
You are listening to Dirty Hands by Gula.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years. So it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Hey, my name is Betsy Andrews, executive editor of Savera Magazine, and I am hanging out at the coolest, most delicious place in the world, heritageradionetwork.org.
Now it's time for a musical guest who's gonna sing a song or two.
This is Joshua David Stein of the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour, half hour. Welcome to our second half. The first half was a somewhat dry discussion about shrimp, and the second half is our not at all dry musical guest. So I invited a Delta blues musician from Western Pennsylvania here today named Hugh Poole. Hi, Hugh.
Hello, Joshua. How are you?
I'm doing well. And the reason why I did is because one of my favorite shrimp songs is called Dead Shrimp Blues by Robert Johnson. Hugh, tell me everything you know about Dead Shrimp Blues in 30 seconds.
I know that it was one of 27 songs that Robert Johnson recorded in Texas in a hotel room. I know that it was released on the King of the Delta Blues Singers Volume 2. And I know that, having listened to it a lot, I think it's about sperm.
What gives you that impression? Or do you think every song is about sperm?
No, I don't. But I think it's the mournful tone in which he sings about the loss of his shrimp. All my shrimps are dead and gone.
Yeah, maybe his briefs were too tight.
I think it's possible.
So you're going to play a couple of songs, mm-hmm. one from your new record, Keep On Moving, with Mule Bone, the duo you're part of.
Yep.
But let's start off with the Robert Johnson tune.
That's what I thought. Just like a kid in ball, you better come on in my kitchen. It's gonna be rain out there.
come on, in my kitchen. Gonna be raining outdoors.
That is a sexy tune.
It is, isn't it?
I mean, something about the Delta blues that we were just talking about it is how much food plays a part in it. Like, yeah. That's coming to my kitchen, and then you have talking about all the jelly roll and meat shaking and everything. I guess everything can mean a sexual innuendo, but food, it's like, it's just fit for it.
Food and music, you know, it's a pretty good pairing.
Food, music, and sex. It's a great trifecta.
Yes. Yes, yes, it is.
So before you launch into the next tune, can you just tell our listeners a little bit of, like, what makes something a Delta blues tune as opposed to, you know?
Typically, there are different kinds. I guess typically, you know, we don't have much time, but whatever. But typically, a Delta blues tune, like Robert Johnson since Dead Trim Blues, it's got kind of a droney thing happening. A lot of the music that came, even from West Texas and whatever, a lot of the music has that drone thing, as opposed to,
right,
which is more of a Piedmont country style. Most of the Delta blues has like a straight kind of quarter note. Even with your thumb, you just kind of keep, you're playing in the key of E, so that the low string on the guitar, you just kind of keep a quarter note going on that.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah, and it's, and
which
it's,
gives it like this building intensity. It's
it just... does. And also with the Delta blues stuff too, there's a lot of like, it's not like bright sonority music. You know, the sonority of the music is not bright.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's in major tuning, this is like open G tunes, banjo tuning essentially. But there's a lot of the, you know, the just all the those are all notes from the pentatonic scale, but you got to kind of play them a little bit, like drag them off a little bit.
It's
like
a little
that.
Bit of a downer.
Yeah, kind of. But I don't know. But hey, man, you know, I mean,
it's not called the blues for nothing.
Right, but it's what it's. We celebrate what we have in common, you know, about the world. You know, mostly everybody has the same damn problems.
Right.
And the blues celebrates that, and through celebrating it, you know, we make each other feel better because it's like you're not alone.
Yeah.
You know?
Let's hear the second tune. So this one is from your new album.
Yep.
Tell us a little bit about it, and then off you go.
Well, I got the idea to play it listening in on the Shrimp Conversation.
Okay.
Because I got the idea to write it after the Gulf thing, like 4 years, whatever, it was 5-6 years ago,
yeah,
when the well let go, letting the oil go into the Gulf of Mexico, Halliburton was actually there were the people in charge of it, you know, and their name just disappeared from the news story like overnight,
right.
Like 24 hours later, no one mentioned it, but the initial reporting was that the well cost half a billion a day, and they were trying to get it out and get finished.
Right.
And he found out later on that it actually hadn't been tested properly, because to test it, you had to destroy it, but you're supposed to conduct the test every 7 years, and this one hadn't been tested, whatever. So anyway, so that thing was just like, man, if you have enough money, you know, it's a cynical tune, because it's just like, if you have enough money to hire a legal team, or better yet, to just have politicians to change the policy.
Like the vice president.
Right, you can do whatever the hell you want.
Yeah.
Whereas the rest of us,
shrimpers included,
yeah, got to do what we got to do.
Okay.
It's called Toe That Line. I did a pretty good job retuning on the break there. Ah. I'm gonna scoop you up and snatch you, and toe that line, I'll pay somebody who will. Toe that line, 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 toe Toe that line of pace, buddy, you will. Toe that line of pace, buddy, you will. Well, oh no, here we go. Spent the night on here before. Made a solemn promise not to do it again. Sure enough, was enough. I hear my stuff out in a rough. And John stumbled on it when it was my turn again. Toe that line, oh, the man come get you. Toe that line, oh, you're posting bail. Toe that line, I'm gonna scoop you up and snatch you. Toe that line of pace, buddy, you will. Toe that line. To that line of peace, buddy, you will. To that line of peace, buddy, you will. Our oil is spilling out into the ocean and money spilling into the banker's hands. Trust has run out on the horizon, but the message is received. Take what you can. To that line on the bank, I'm gonna get you. To that line on your post and bail. To that line, I'm gonna scoop you up and snatch you. To that line of peace, buddy, you will. To that line. To that line. To that line of peace, buddy, you will. To that line of peace, buddy, you will. Come get you to that line, I'm gonna post a man. To that line, I'm gonna scoop you up and snatch you. To that line, of business, buddy, you will. To that line, to that line, to that line, of business, buddy, you will. To that line, of business, buddy, you will. Well, compliance, compliance is preached with both fists. You can live in defiance, but you sleep in the ditch. Take a look around, tell me, what do y'all see? Is this your daddy's dream of democracy? To that line, oh, the man come get you. To that line, oh, you post a bail. To that line, I'm gonna scoop you up and snatch you. To that line, I'm busy, buddy, you will. To that line. To that line. To that line, I'm busy, buddy, you will. To that line, I'm busy, buddy, you will. Well, oh no, here we go. Spent the night on here before. I made a solid promise not to do it again. Sure enough, was enough. I hit my stuff out in the rough, but John stumbled on it when he was marching in. To that line, oh, the man come and get you. To that line, oh, your post and bail. To that line, I'm gonna scoop you up and snatch you. To that line, I'm pissing, buddy, you will. To that line, oh, the man come and get you. To that line, oh, your post and bail. To that line, I'm gonna scoop you up and snatch you. To that line, I'm pissing, buddy, you will. To that line. To that line. To that line of peace, buddy, you will. To that line of peace, buddy, you will. To that line of peace, buddy, you will. To that line of peace, buddy, you will.
Great stuff. Hugh, you want to give us a very basic Delta Blues send-off, and I'll take us out on that?
You talking about playing guitar?
That was a shrimp episode of the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour Half Hour. I'd like to thank all of our guests, Sarah Curry from Raising Shrimp, George Motz from Head On Shrimping in the Low Country, Liz Smith, our wonderful engineer, and Hugh Poole, currently tearing it up on the, what is that, the National?
National Steel Guitar.
National Steel Guitar. I'll see you next week on the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour Half Hour. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving, and good night.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.